We shall simply have to ignore that pull, as you call it. We are both adults. I am a lady and you a gentleman. Surely we can control our baser instincts. When she spoke like that, so haughty and self-righteous, he felt he would rather strangle her than kiss her, but when he looked down to avoid glaring directly at her, he noticed she had lost her slippers and stood barefoot on the carpet. Her toes were small and round and peeking prettily out from under the white folds of her robe. And just like that, he wanted her again. "We should set an example for the children," she said, warming to her topic. "Surely they have seen the worst in humanity. We should strive to show them the best and the purest." Neil looked up at her, one brow rising.
"If you are looking for a paragon of virtue, I am not he."
Her mouth turned down. "I only meant..."
"I'm a former soldier, my lady. I only survived because of my, as you put it, baser instincts. I'm not proud of all I've done, but neither do I feel like I have to pretend to be something I am not so that children who are unlikely to ever overcome the stigma of their birth can be presented some unattainable myth of morality."
She drew in a breath, and Neil steeled himself for the lecture to come. But instead of railing at him, she seemed to deflate as quickly as a punctured balloon.
"You are correct. None of us is perfect. You are a hero, and..."
Neil laughed.
"Hero? What do you know of me that you think I am a hero?"
She gave him an annoyed look.
"I did read the letters of introduction my father sent. You served in the war against Napoleon. My father said you were instrumental in his defeat and showed uncommon valour." "Those were his exact words. My father is many things, but he is not the sort of man to give praise lightly."
"What do you know of the war?"
She paused, not seeming to know where to begin.
"Have you ever heard of Lieutenant Colonel Draven?" he asked.
She shook her head.
"The survivors."
"The survivors? It sounds like a name people might give to the boys here."
It did at that, and it would have been no less accurate for these unwanted children than it had been for his troop of younger sons of nobility.
"It's what we called ourselves."
Neil moved closer to the fire. Without her body pressed against his, he suddenly felt chilled. He could see her shivering and gestured for her to come closer. She did, but she moved warily, as though he might pounce on her at any moment. Or perhaps she feared she would pounce. He could only dream. He leaned against her desk and she sat in the chair closest to the fire. When he was warm again, he cleared his throat, trying to decide how much to tell her.
"We started out as a troop of 30. We were chosen by Lieutenant Colonel Draven. He selected me first and asked me to lead. I picked some of the other men, men I knew or had served with, and others he chose because they had special skills. He'd been asked to form a troop like ours weeks before he ever tapped me, and he'd been watching and making lists of men who would serve our purposes."
Her brow wrinkled.
"A troop like yours? What sort of troop was it?"
"A suicide troop," he answered boldly. "Draven looked for the best, the brightest, and the expendable. None of us were expected to survive the first mission, much less the entire war."
She stared at his face.
"But why would any man agree to serve in such a group?"
"Not every man Draven or I asked agreed. All of the men who did agree had one response in common."
"What was that?"
Draven began every interview with the same question. "Are you afraid to die?" The men who said no, the men who had the skills we needed, were the men chosen.
She looked away from him and into the fire, seeming to consider all he had said for some time. The fire popped and crackled, and Neil began to think she wouldn't respond at all. But then she looked up at him.
"And you answered no. Is it true? You aren't afraid to die?"
Neil gave her a wry smile.
"Oh, I'm afraid to die. I've seen men die in the most horrible ways you can imagine. I'd be a fool not to fear death after what I've seen."
"But you said..."
"I never said I wasn't a fool. More accurately, I was half out of my mind. When Draven approached me about leading the troop, I was half mad with grief and rage. I wanted to die. He saw that. She shot up quite suddenly.
And so he used that grief against you and sent you to your death? Was she indignant on his behalf?
Neil wasn't certain how to respond. No one had ever become indignant for him before.
"You have it wrong, sweetheart," he said.
"Draven didn't send me to die. He gave me a reason to live."
Neil had never thought of it this way before, but it was true. Draven's missions had given Neil new purpose, new focus. He'd been able to think of something beyond the death of Christopher. He had still wanted to avenge Christopher's death, but he'd also wanted to keep his men alive. The more he'd come to know the men of his troop, Ewan the Protector, Rafe the Seducer, and the others like Jasper, Phineas, Duncan and Nash, the more he'd wanted to keep them alive. Draven had saved Neil, even when Neil hadn't wanted to be saved. But it begged the question, the one Neil asked when he was sober and sweating from nightmares. What had Draven saved him for?
"Don't call me sweetheart."
Neil cut his gaze to her. He'd almost forgotten she was there.
Almost. "My apologies, Lady Juliana."
"Julia," she said, shuffling uncomfortably. "I suppose if we are to live so closely for the next few days, you should call me Julia." He nodded.
"Julia suits you." It did, with her wild copper hair, the wildness being partly his fault, her deep brown eyes and her wide smile. Julia had an informal and nurturing sound that fit her.
"But paragon of virtue that you are, I'll continue to refer to you as Lady Juliana."
She scowled at him. "I simply thought we might be friends." He raised a brow.
"I have friends. I don't want to kiss them." And that was the least of what he imagined doing with Juliana. No, he did not feel friendly toward her at all.
"Thank you for telling me about your part in the war. The boys are fortunate to have you here. They need a father figure."
Neil held up his hand. "Don't imagine my presence here to be any more than it is. I am here to keep you safe from Slag and to bring you home to your father. That is all." She took in a breath.
"No, I wouldn't want you to do any more than what my father hired you to do."
She tried to walk past him, but he grabbed her arm. That was a mistake. The softness of her skin and the feel of her warm flesh beneath his reminded him he wanted to kiss her again, but she did not turn to look at him, her gaze fixed on the door.
"I am not a servant to be hired. I am here as a favor because your father and mine are such good friends, and if you want the truth of it, I would prefer... I think we would all prefer. You simply go home."
She turned to look directly at him.
"I am never going home. This is where I belong. These boys need me."
She pulled her arm away, cradling it as though he had burned her.
"Do they need you, or do you need them?" Neil asked.
Without an answer, she swept out of the room. Neil was left to his own thoughts and desires. The empty room seemed larger without Julia in it. He sat back on the couch and stared at the fire. Why the devil had he kissed her? He was a man in control of his passions, so why had he allowed them to get the better of him tonight? Yes, she was attractive. Yes, she made his blood thrum when she was near. Yes, he wanted to both throttle her and trace her curves with his hands, but that didn't mean he should act on those impulses. Her father had asked Neil to keep her safe, not seduce her. If Neil could just convince her to go home to her father, this would all be over. She felt some loyalty to the boys. That was understandable, but they could find another woman, or better yet, a man, to run the orphanage. She could go back to whatever it was she did before, and he could go back to... What the hell did he have to go back to? Nightmares. Playing billiards with Rafe. Having the occasional meal with Ewan and telling war stories with Jasper. And what else was he supposed to do? He couldn't go back to the army, and he wasn't suited to the clergy. Besides, the allowance his father gave him was enough to support Neil twice over. As long as he didn't see the need to become an icon of fashion or gamble excessively, Neil would never have to work again. Which meant he was still 30 and completely without purpose. He sat up straighter, but that did not mean this orphanage was his purpose. He'd rather face the French army again than spend the rest of his days tucking children in for naps and ensuring the pet rats were where they ought to be. And yet he couldn't deny that in only 2 days he'd stopped looking at the boys as a passel of bastards and saw them more as individuals. He no longer remembered his own shame growing up every time he looked at them, but neither did he want to adopt any of them. Except, possibly, Charlie. He liked that boy. He'd never seen anyone able to do so many chores one-handed since his thumb was always in his mouth. Neil remembered sucking his thumb when he'd been young, but long before he was 4, he'd had his knuckles bruised and cut every time his thumb snaked its way into his mouth. He remembered being woken in the middle of the night to have his knuckles wrapped once because his thumb had sneaked into his mouth when he'd been asleep. It had all been done by his father's order, and it certainly hadn't made Neil love the man, who was a stranger at best and a tyrant at worst. He might have been raised in a home and given all the food, clothing, and education necessary for a boy, but Neil hadn't grown up with any more of a family than these orphans. His thoughts were interrupted by the squeak of one of the boards on the stairs. He'd been up and down those front stairs enough to know every sound the boards made. He'd repaired the rotting boards, but he hadn't fixed any of the squeaks on the sound planks. One never knew when one might need advanced warning. Rising silently, Neil moved out of the parlour and into the entryway. He kept to the shadows, his back against the wall as he watched the lone boy make his way down the steps. The boy was stealthy, no doubt about it. He'd made the error of stepping on one creaky stair, but he didn't repeat his mistake. Neil watched as he carefully skipped or sidestepped other creaky stairs. It was the shaggy mane of hair that finally identified Walter, even in the low light. Neil had known it wasn't the tall boy, whatever his name was, but he thought it might be the helpful one. Except that one had straight hair that looked to have seen a barber at some point recently. Neil should have known it was Walter. The boy had been trouble from the first. Walter jumped off the last stair, obviously elated that he'd made it, and made straight for the front door. Before he could reach for the new bolt, Neil cleared his throat. Walter froze.
"Where do you think you are going?"
Neil asked, moving into the entryway, which was periodically lit up from the bolts of lightning outside. Walter spun around.
"Nowhere?"
He started back for the steps, obviously intending to pretend the whole incident hadn't happened and he was going back to bed.
"Hold it."
Neil's voice was all it took for the boy to freeze.
"I asked you a question, and I want an answer."
The boy stood in front of the stairs, head down and shoulders hunched. Neil moved closer.
"I'm interested in where a child of 8...
9,
Walter corrected.
9, then. Where a child of 9 thinks to go in the middle of the night and during a rainstorm. Why aren't you sleeping?"
"The thunder woke me,"
the answer was given quickly. Too quickly.
"And so you decided to take a stroll in the storm?"
I was walking in my sleep."
Neil nodded, coming to stand in front of Walter.
"Amazing how you can avoid the stairs that creak, even when you're walking in your sleep."
Walter's head jerked up.
"Fine. You caught me. It's not a crime to go for a walk."
"No, but it seems to me you are asking for trouble if you go out in the middle of the night in London, especially in this area of London."
"I can take care of myself."
"And how will you do that?"
"I can fight."
Neil nodded.
"Let me see."
Walter frowned.
"What do you mean?"
"Imagine I walk up to you and threaten you. What do you do? Run?"
"I don't need to run."
He pulled a knife from his pocket. Neil eyed it, unimpressed.
"So that's where all the knives in the kitchen have gone."
"I didn't take them all."
"Who else has one?"
Walter looked away.
"I'm no snitch."
"No, you're a fighter. You know how to use that knife?"
"I can hold my own."
"Show me."
Walter stared at him, uncomprehending. In the distance, thunder boomed again.
"Defend yourself with the knife,"
Neil said.
"But..."
"I give you leave.
Cut me, prick me, do your worst."
Walter narrowed his eyes.
"Clever boy," Neil thought. He knew there was a condition coming. that if I manage to come away unscathed, unhurt, untouched, if I come away intact, and I am able to take the knife away from you, you tell me where you were off to.
Sure.
Lightning flashed, the light illuminating Walter's cocksure expression. The truth, Walter. Give me your word.
You'll never get this knife away from me.
Then you have no reason not to swear to me. Still, Walter hesitated, which Neil took as a good sign. The boy considered his word to be binding. He was not yet beyond reform.
And if I do cut you? If I keep the knife?
Walter asked. Then you're free to go. No questions asked and no retribution. Walter frowned at him. That means I won't try and hurt you. No revenge. Agreed? Walter nodded. Then go ahead. Come after me. Walter took a moment to study him. Another good sign, in Neil's opinion. The boy didn't lunge or act without thinking. There was hope for him yet. And when Walter seemed to back away, almost as though he would run, instead he pivoted and slashed out at Neil. It was a good move, a good bluff, but not good enough. Neil stepped to the side, easily avoiding Walter's strike. When Walter's arm jabbed at the air where Neil had been, Neil reached out, twisted Walter's wrist, and the knife dropped neatly into Neil's other hand. Neil twirled the knife and pocketed it. Walter stared for a long moment.
You cheated!
Neil crossed his arms. That's a serious accusation. I'd think before making it if I were you. Walter opened his mouth as though to protest again, then closed it. He muttered something that sounded like, "You didn't cheat," then lifted his face to glower at Neil.
How did you do that?
Maybe I'll teach you some day, but right now, you owe me an answer.
I don't have to tell you anything.
Walter crossed his arms over his chest. You gave me your word. Walter seemed to consider this. Neil waited. Neil felt a growing sense of anticipation. He didn't know why he should care, whether the boy honored his word or not, but he wanted Walter to do the noble thing. Finally, Walter let out a huff of air.
You won, fair and square. I'll tell you that I was on my way to the Oxen Bull.
Slag's place. Neil tensed. Had Slag not only recruited Goring, but the children as well? Are you part of Slag's gang? Walter shrugged. You want to be. Walter looked up at him.
People are afraid of Mr. Slag. If I work with him, he'll keep me safe. I'll be one of his boys.
Neil nodded. He and Walter had more in common than Neil had expected. Both of them longed for family. Joining Slag's gang of criminals wasn't the way to find it. And what sort of work would you do for Slag? Pickpockets? Pilfer shops? I'm sure he has a dozen rackets for a boy of your age.
He can use me.
And that's exactly what he'll do. You steal for him, and if you're caught, you suffer the consequences while he gets rich.
I'm young. The judges are lean. Lennon, they go easy on you if you're young.
They might not give you as much jail time, but you'll find yourself in Newgate for a few months. Do you have any idea what happens to young boys like you in Newgate? Walter swallowed. Neil nodded. So you have an idea. It's not a place you want to spend even one dark night, much less 60 of them.
Maybe I'm willing to take my chances. What have I got to lose?
Those were the words Neil knew well. How many times had he said them? Thought them. At his lowest, his most hate-filled, Neil hadn't thought he had anything to lose, but that was before the nightmares and the skittishness every time someone shot a rifle. Neil hadn't realized he'd lose the men he counted as close as brothers. He hadn't counted on losing pieces of his heart, bloody shard by bloody shard, every time one of his men died.
"Look around you,"
Neil said, his voice hoarse from emotion. Walter didn't seem to notice. Neil put his arm around the boy's shoulders, turning him so he could catch a glimpse of the orphanage.
This is what you have to lose. Walter snorted. A leaky old building filled with a bunch of smelly boys. I say good riddance.
Neil held Walter in place when the boy would have shrugged him off. You're not looking hard enough, Walter.
Walter stilled and looked around again. I don't see anything special.
I do. You are fortunate to have a roof over your head. A leaky roof. Not when I am through with it. But I promise you, there were nights during the war I would have given all the coin in my pocket for a leaky roof or any sort of roof. You know what else?
What?
I would have given a month's wages for a bed and a blanket and food in my belly. You have all that.
They give you some of that in the army, don't they?
Of course, but I wasn't in the regular army. I was part of a special troop, and we had to travel light. We slept under the stars, or in the rain, or in the cold. We didn't have a supply cart to provide us provisions. We bought what we could, begged for some, and stole the rest.
You stole?
Neil released Walter and sat on the second to bottom step. Walter sat next to him.
I stole food, weapons, clothes, whatever I could from the enemy. War doesn't feel quite so honorable when your belly is empty and your feet bare. But you know what got me through?
The battles? All the explosions?
No. Neil gave him a long look. My friends. There were 30 of us to start, but only 12 came back. A dozen men, just like you have here.
Aw, most of these orphans are crybabies. They aren't men.
Then show them how to be strong. Be a leader. One day they will be men. One day you'll be out of this place. You'll want friends you can trust. Friends who will have your back no matter what happens.
Do you have friends like that?
Absolutely. You met Mr. Mostyn already. When I'm in a scrape, Mostyn and my other friends are the first to come to my aid. Walter seemed to consider this.
You were the leader. What did they call you? Major?
Neil shook his head.
What had ranks meant when the men died side by side? Neil might have given the final orders, but he dug the graves of the men they lost right beside the rest of the men.
They called me the warrior.
Why?
Because I had been a soldier before, and because he considered how to explain the lust for revenge he had felt when he'd first formed the troop.
I was the most devoted to war.
I could be a warrior, Walter said. I can fight.
He jumped up and moved his feet like a boxer, holding his fists up in front of his face.
If you want to be a soldier, you'd better stay out of trouble and get an education. Lady Juliana will have a tutor for you soon.
Reading and writing and numbers? I don't need any of that.
Then how do you think to read your orders, or write reports, or plan troop movements?
I don't want to do any of that. I just want to fight.
Ah, so you want to be an infantryman. I always preferred the cavalry. I was in the 16th Light Dragoons. They're known as the Queen's Lancers.
Neil scratched his jaw thoughtfully.
Nothing like riding a horse into the heat of battle and saving the day for the infantry. But you need some education to be a dragoon.
One needed money, too. But if Walter ever made something of himself, Neil would make sure he was able to buy the commission of his choice. It was the least he could do for a child who understood what it was like to grow up without a family.
I'll think about it, Walter said,
apparently unwilling to commit verbally. Neil knew the look in the boy's eyes. He was intrigued and won over by the image of himself on horseback, charging heroically into battle.
Then back to bed with you. You'll need your rest, because tomorrow we repair the roof.
Walter pulled a face.
Aw.
And I'll teach you and the other lads how to behave like soldiers, how to salute, stand at attention, how to march.
Really? I can't wait.
Walter ran up 2 steps, then ran back down 2, and hugged Neil hard. Neil raised his arms, but couldn't quite make himself return the embrace. The boy didn't notice. He scampered back up the steps and down the hallway. Neil didn't think he'd have any more trouble with Walter tonight, but he knew this was only the first sally. And there were more truculent foes to consider, too. The tall, sullen boy to begin with. Billy. Was that his name? He might not give Neil trouble outright, but that was because Billy was still sizing him up. Neil was sizing him up as well, and Billy wouldn't give up his knives so easily.
11.
Julia ducked into the shadows of the drawing room at the top of the stairs as Walter raced by her. The boy hadn't even known she was there, and neither had Raxel. Or perhaps she should think of him as the warrior. She'd gone back to her room after their kiss, and she hadn't been able to calm herself enough to lie down. No wonder, as she'd never been kissed like that in her life. None of the kisses she'd received previously could even compare, and she would have remembered. Her body still vibrated from the feel of his hands on her, her lips still tingled. Her heart had continued thumping hard in her chest. No, she would not soon forget the warrior's kiss. She would still remember how it made her feel when she was an old, old woman. She wouldn't have heard the noise if she hadn't been pacing in her room, but she had heard the voices and crept out, half afraid Mr. Slag had returned. And despite all her protests about Raxel's presence here, she was certainly happy he was nearby in that moment. Except it hadn't been Slag at all. It had been Raxel and Walter. Julia had ducked into the drawing room so she wouldn't be spotted. She'd almost revealed herself when Raxel had challenged Walter to stab him, but she should have known a former soldier could handle a mere boy. What she couldn't have known was how the boy and the man would melt her heart. She'd never particularly liked Walter. He wasn't sweet like James or adorable like Charlie. He wasn't smart like Michael or helpful like Robbie. And he certainly didn't want her love like Sean or Chester. Walter had always pushed her away. No matter which method she employed to get to know him, he'd wanted nothing to do with her. But he'd embraced the warrior. Julia wouldn't have believed it if she hadn't seen it. She almost hadn't, as she should have been hiding and not sticking her head out to watch. What made it even worse was all the weeping. When Raxel had talked about his friends, tears had streamed from her eyes. She could hear the sorrow in his voice, and knew that, though he made war sound heroic and glorious to Walter, the warrior found it anything but. And that could only mean one thing. Raxel cared about these children. He might say he couldn't look at them. He might dislike that the orphans reminded him of the circumstances of his own birth, but they were winning him over, just as the boys had won her over. Not that she had been a difficult case. She could grudgingly admit she had a soft heart. Unfortunately, Raxel was winning her over, too. He touched her heart tonight when he told Walter to look around and to think what he had. The man really did see and understand what she was trying to do here and what she wanted to give these boys. And the way he'd put his arm about Walter, the way he'd spoken to him softly but firmly, the way he'd counseled him and melted her heart, Raxel reminded her of her own father before her mother had died. Then he had been a different man, one who had always taken the time to listen to Julia's stories and praise her childish drawings and encourage her in piano and singing, even though every instructor had declared she had no musical talent. Not all men were kind like her father, though. She'd come to think of him as the exception, not the rule. Damien Holbrook, Viscount Lanesborough, had showed her what most men were truly like. And who was to say the warrior was not the same as Lanesborough once the layers were peeled back? Hadn't Damien been charming and kind when he'd courted Harriet? Hadn't he been everything genteel and charming even after they married? Then he'd grown tired of his new wife, and Harriet had come home, weeping and inconsolable, because the man she'd fallen in love with was not the man she'd married. The man she'd married was selfish, callous, and lecherous. He'd gone to town for the season, leaving her at his country home because she had been too ill with the first symptoms of pregnancy to join him at routs and balls. Instead, he'd found a mistress, and all the papers had reported their great love affair, making Harriet look like a complete fool. And yet Julia might have forgiven him that behaviour. She was not the sort of person to hold a grudge, but she could never, ever forgive what he'd done after Davy had been born. And now Julia was tempted to trust this warrior, this Mr. Raxel, though she feared she would be making the same mistake Harriet made. The sisters had grown up in the ton. They had been weaned on scandal, raised on gossip, and educated early as to the differences between rumour and innuendo. That men and women were often unfaithful in their marriages was no surprise. Their father had not been quite as censorious with the papers as he ought to have been, and so Julia and Harriet always knew when the Duke or Earl or Marquess of somewhere and the new actress from Drury Lane or the new opera singer or the new Viscountess took up together, leaving their respective spouses to hold their heads high and ignore the liaison. It was simply that Julia and Harriet had always considered that sort of behaviour to belong to other people. Never in their wildest imaginings did they suppose the man they married would be the one to flaunt his paramour. And when Harriet came home in just such a situation, Julia was not as shocked as her sister, but it didn't make the blow any less painful. If only she'd known that wasn't the worst outrage her brother-in-law would perpetrate on the family. Wraxall might not look as though he was made from the same cloth as Viscount Lanesborough, but how could she be certain? She'd known him but 2 days, and she could not allow one dizzying kiss to completely addle her brain and weaken her resolve. With that thought in mind, she retired to bed. Unfortunately, she did not sleep well, and she was still rather groggy the next morning when Mr. Wraxall knocked on her bedroom door at barely 7:30. She'd been finishing dressing her hair and thought it must be Charlie, as he was always awake first.
"Charlie?" she asked through the door.
"It's Wraxall."
Julia closed her mouth. She'd been about to invite Charlie in. She could not extend the same invitation to Wraxall.
"One moment."
She gave her image reflected in the cheval glass an annoyed frown, then hurried to the door, her hair pinned on one side and loose on the other.
"Yes?"
Wraxall stared at her.
"Is that a new style?"
She blew out a breath.
"You know very well it is not. I supposed you had come to my room with a matter of some urgency. If the matter can wait..."
He stuck his hand in the gap between the door and the casement, stopping her from closing the door.
"It is a matter of concern. You have a line of women at the kitchen door. As the rain hasn't slowed, I told one of the boys to let them in. They're currently dripping on the kitchen floor."
Julia stared at him.
"A group of women in the kitchen?"
"Yes."
"They stood outside in the rain?"
"That's what I said. They're here for the cook's position. What do you want me to do with them?"
"The cook's position, of course. The advertisement must have run in the Times. Send them to the parlour."
He frowned.
"Then they'll drip on the rug."
She waved her hands.
"Then keep them in the kitchen."
"How do we prepare breakfast?"
Julia let out a huff. Men in their stomachs. But she could hardly be annoyed when Wraxall was apparently prepared, again, to cook the morning meal.
"Very well. What do you suggest we do with them?"
"Put them in the entryway. There aren't any rugs, and they'll be out of the way."
"Fine."
She stepped out of her room and closed the door.
"You send them to the entryway, and I'll bring the first one to the parlour to interview."
She started down the stairs to the kitchen with Wraxall right beside her. Finally, they would have a cook. One of her problems would be solved. She would not think of the other half-dozen she faced. Namely, what she would do when Slag confronted her at the Darlington Musicale. They reached the bottom of the staircase, but before she could push the door open, Wraxall pulled her back against the wall. Julia caught her breath. She had never thought about how narrow the servant's staircase was, or how enclosed and private. She could hear the prospective cook's voices on the other side of the door, but in the stairwell, she and Wraxall were quite alone.
"What are you doing?" she whispered.
Did he think to kiss her again? Her heart clenched with hope, while her belly fluttered with fear. She did not want him to kiss her again. Did she? Certainly not here and not now. But her gaze drifted to his mouth, and her lips suddenly felt quite dry. She licked them, and Wraxall's hand, which had been reaching for her, paused in mid-air.
"Don't tempt me,"
he murmured, low enough for her to hear, but not loud enough to carry over the din in the kitchen. His voice slid over her like warm velvet.
"Tempt you?" she hissed. "If you think I want you to kiss me, you are sorely mistaken."
"I don't think you want me to kiss you," he answered.
Well, that was good then. She had at least made one point clear to him the night before.
"I know you want me to kiss you."
Julia sputtered, too shocked to form a coherent thought or sentence.
"But that is not my intent.
He reached for her again, but this time she caught his wrist.
"Do not touch me."
He lowered his hand and shrugged.
"Fine.
Go in like that?"
"Fine."
She turned to the door, then looked back at him.
"Like what?"
He twirled a finger, indicating her head.
"With that new style in your hair."
Julia gasped, her hands flying to her head. She'd completely forgotten her hair was only half pinned. And she'd thought he wanted to kiss her. No doubt he wanted to laugh, just looking at her in all her ridiculousness. She moved back from the door, but he anticipated her.
"There's no time now,"
he said, and reached for her again. This time, she didn't move quickly enough, and his hands slid into her hair. She stiffened, unable to move as his fingers searched deftly for the pins she'd slid into the mass to secure it. Her scalp tingled as, one by one, he removed the pins, dropping them into his hand. Her hair fell down about her shoulders. When she glanced at him again, she felt very young and somehow more vulnerable with her hair loose.
"That suits you better. You look too matronly with your hair wound on top of your head."
There were more flattering styles, but one needed a hairdresser to achieve those, and before he'd come, Julia hadn't cared what her hair looked like, as long as it was out of her way.
"I am the matron of this house, in case you've forgotten."
"Oh, you wouldn't allow me to forget that point. And as such, you cannot interview these ladies with your hair undone. You need something."
He tapped his finger on his lips.
"Ah."
This time she swatted his hand away when he reached for her bosom.
"What are you about, sir?"
He caught her hand and smiled at her. It was a rogue smile, if she'd ever seen one. She knew she should not have trusted him.
"Not what you are thinking about, though you seem to have found a way to make even drab grey look enticing."
She looked down at her muted dress, a dress she had put on without much thought this morning.
"What do you—"
He reached for the bodice again, but when she would have slapped him away, he murmured,
"Trust me."
Those were exactly the words that should have sounded the alarm in her head and her heart. Instead, she stood completely still while his fingers caught hold of the dark blue ribbon adorning the dress's bodice. The bodice did not have a particularly low neck, but it was a dress suitable for multiple occasions. As it was morning, and she was supposed to be the head of the orphanage, she had tucked a thin, gauzy fichu in the bodice to cover the modest flesh exposed by the rounded style. Raxel's fingers crushed the flimsy material as he pulled the ribbon from its bow and gently tugged it free from its moorings. Julia could not have breathed if she'd wanted to. His fingers, though not straying from their task, burned her flesh wherever they touched. The feel of the ribbon being pulled free made Julia all the more aware that Raxel might move his hand but a tiny fraction, and he would be cupping her breast. She found, inexplicably, that she wanted to feel his hands on her, and the more she imagined his hands on her, the heavier her breasts felt, and the more her nipples hardened, until the peaks strained against the light fabric of her chemise. She gulped in a deep breath, feeling much like a fish that's been tossed on land. Horrified, she couldn't help but notice that when she breathed in, the tops of her breasts rose from the dresser's bodice and encountered Raxel's warm fingers. A gentleman would have pulled his hand away. Raxel didn't move any part of himself except for his eyes, which lifted from their focus on the ribbon to meet her gaze. Those eyes, usually so blue and clear, were the colour of a stormy sea. Heat seemed to burn off the man, radiating in waves and washing over her. He nodded slightly, and Julia felt as though some agreement had been made between the two of them, some promise that would be honoured later. She did not know precisely what it might be, but her body seemed to understand it. Her body swayed closer to him, even as her mind cautioned her to flee. She might have run back up the steps too if he hadn't put his arms around her. They didn't go around her exactly, but he reached behind her, gathering her hair into a long tail. Her whole body came alive as little frissons of pleasure trailed from her scalp to her neck and all the way to her toes. He looped the ribbon about her hair and tied it into a bow, then slowly, far more slowly than necessary, he stepped back and away from her. She still could not catch her breath, and she knew her chest rose and fell as she gulped in air.
His eyes assessed her, initially inspecting his handiwork, but then drifting to the motion of her chest, and then to the folds of her skirt where her legs formed a V. Oh yes, she was warm there, too. Moisture had gathered, and with it a ripple of awareness, but he couldn't know what she felt at the juncture of her thighs. Could he?
You had better go in now.
She nodded and stood motionless. In one smooth movement, Raxel pushed the door to the kitchen open and extended an arm in invitation. Julia closed her eyes to clear her head, then marched through the kitchen to the vestibule, smiling broadly at the potential cooks waiting for her. After Neil had moved Lady Juliana's applicants to the entryway, he corralled the orphans upstairs. There was no point in scaring the cooks away before they'd even interviewed. He'd planned to repair the roof today, but a steady drizzle, interspersed with heavier deluges, thwarted his plans. Perhaps that was for the best. He was so weary he would probably fall off the roof if he attempted to repair it. One of these nights he would have to sleep, and at some point he hoped he would be able to go home. He'd sent for clean clothing and washed in the servants' quarters, so at least he was clean and properly attired. He'd also managed to waylay Goring, who had returned this morning with a story of a sick relative. Neil intended to keep the manservant close and Slag uninformed. When he had all the children gathered in the older boy's room, Neil issued his orders. "We can't work on the roof this morning, and you still have no teacher for lessons." A resounding shout drowned him out. Neil ignored it. He raised one hand, and the din quieted. "So, we will make use of our time by cleaning your quarters." "Boo!" was the response. Neil crossed his arms over his chest. "Gentlemen, when I want your opinion, I will give it to you. In the meantime, strip the beds, push all the furniture to one corner, get the broom, find a mop and bucket, and start cleaning." He turned to the four younger boys. "Mr. Goring will help you." Goring frowned.
"I ain't a maid, sir."
"You are today, Goring. Be thankful you don't have to do it all on your own."
The four younger boys scampered off, full of excitement, and Neil turned back to the chaos in the older boy's dormitory. Before he knew what had happened, the red-haired boy pushed a box into his arms.
"You better hold on to these, Major, or they're likely to get free."
Neil looked down at the three rats, who blinked up at him. He took a deep breath. He'd never cared much for rats. He'd encountered them plenty of times on missions when he'd had to camp in dark cellars or fetid alleys. These rats were certainly cleaner and tamer. One of them rose up on its hind legs and sniffed at him with its little pink nose. Neil didn't shudder, but he wouldn't go so far as to call the creature cute. He resolved to build a proper cage for the little beasts, but until then he took the box and placed it inside Lady Juliana's room. He made a point not to look around, not to imagine her in that silk nightgown he'd seen snatches of last night. Leaving the rats, he returned to the dormitory in time to see the tall boy, who kept to himself, shove something under his mattress. "You," Neil pointed.
"That's Billy," Michael told him. "He's 11.
Neil had already learned that Michael enjoyed numbers. He counted everything he could.
"What do you have there, Billy?"
Neil made his way over. Billy didn't look him in the eye.
"Nothing, Major."
"What did you hide under the mattress?"
Billy's dark eyes rose and settled on Neil's face. Billy had a maturity beyond his years, and Neil knew that before he'd come to the orphanage, Billy had seen plenty on the streets of London.
"Let's see," Neil said.
Still looking at Neil, Billy lifted the mattress. Underneath, six kitchen knives gleamed. Immediately, the other boys in the chamber found themselves engrossed with other tasks.
"That's quite a collection," Neil remarked. "What do you need the weapons for?"
"Defense."
Neil looked about the room.
"Against these lads? You're bigger than all of them. It seems to me if you had trouble, you could use your fists."
"I'm not worried about these lads,"
Neil nodded.
"Then who?"
Billy shrugged.
"If there's any trouble, I like to be ready."
"I'm here," Neil said. "If there's any trouble, I'll handle it."
Billy nodded.
"How long are you here?"
It was a good question. It was a question Neil continued to ask himself. He'd intended to be here a few hours, then one night. Now he'd been here two nights, and those would undoubtedly turn into three. But he didn't plan to stay after that. He didn't want to run an orphanage. He'd deal with Slag, see Lady Juliana safely home, then say his goodbyes. That would be little consolation to Billy, though. A new thug would move into Slag's place, or a thief desperate enough would find a way to break into the orphanage, and the boys and Lady Juliana would have no one to defend them. No wonder Billy wanted the knives. Neil held out his hand.
Before I go, we'll find a way for you to defend yourself if there's still a need. In the meantime, the new cook will want these.
Billy scooped the knives up in one large fist and handed them over. Neil nodded. I have Walter's knife. He looked at the room of boys who were still pretending not to listen. Who else has a knife or a weapon? Turn them over now. If I find them during my inspection later, you won't like the consequences.
By the end of the hour, Neil had collected three more knives, two bricks, a sharpened stick, two candlesticks that probably belonged in the dining room, and a half-dozen hairpins that Lady Juliana was probably missing. The younger boys had their share of weapons, too. Jimmy had a needle he'd swiped from Lady Juliana's sewing box, and Chester had taken a small pan from the kitchen. By the time Neil disposed of or returned the items and inspected the boys' chambers, it was noon and no one had eaten. He made his way to the parlour, through the now empty entryway. The parlour door was open, and an appetizing smell drifted from the kitchen. He stuck his head in the door, finding Lady Juliana with her head bent and a quill in her hand. She was writing quickly, her lip caught between her teeth as she worked. Neil cleared his throat. She looked up at him, and her cheeks flushed. Just as quickly, she looked down again. He would have bet she was remembering their shared kiss.
"What is it, Mr. Axel?"
She was all business, but Neil wasn't put off.
Something about the sight of her with her copper hair spilling over one shoulder, that full lip between her small, even teeth, made him want to kiss her again.
I wondered how the interviews had gone, and the boys wondered when they might eat.
Her head popped up.
"Oh, no, they haven't eaten at all this morning, have they?"
She rose, dropping her quill.
"How could I have forgotten?"
Neil raised a hand. "I've kept them busy in their rooms, but as the weather is still unfit for travel, I haven't been able to go out and procure any foodstuffs."
"Does that appetizing smell mean you hired a new cook?"
"Yes, a Mrs. Koch. Appropriate, isn't it? Her husband fought in the Colonial War, and after his death she settled in England. She has 9 grown children and is used to cooking for a crowd, so to speak."
"She sounds perfect."
"Yes, I'll ask if she can have something ready for a noon meal."
"Good. If you need me, I'll be in the servants' quarters. I have a project I'd like to begin."
She frowned.
"What sort of project?"
He felt like an idiot telling her he planned to build a cage for the pet rats. He should have been ordering her to release the rodents, but he knew she would refuse. The boys had become attached to the creatures, and they seemed harmless enough.
"It's a surprise for the boys. I'll take Goring with me. If you would be so kind, send something down for us."
"Very well."
She moved in front of the desk, looked toward the door, then leaned toward him, as though telling a secret.
"You are keeping an eye on Mr. Goring."
"I don't want Goring running to tell Slag what we're up to."
She furrowed her brow.
"We aren't up to anything."
"I told you last night."
He moved closer, lowering his voice.
"Slag will not touch you. I'll bring several of my men to the musicale, and we will deal with Mr. Slag."
"You planned to kill him?"
She put her hand to her heart.
"There are worse fates than death. The prison hulks come to mind."
"But..."
He held up a hand.
"Leave it to me. And without Slag in command, his gang will falter. The last thing the men will care about is you or the orphanage. They will be too busy killing each other to determine the next arch-rogue. You can go home."
"I told you, this is my home now."
Neil closed his eyes. Why had he gone to see his father? Why had he agreed to help St. Maur?
"It will take an afternoon," his father had said. "A piece of cake for a man like you," his father had said.
Neil, for one, would have been pleased never to set eyes on cake again.
You cannot save this orphanage, Lady Juliana.
I beg to differ. You just said, with Slag gone, the orphanage would be the last of the gang's concerns.
Until there's a new leader who takes an interest, and then we will have our foodstuff stolen again.
Neil waved a hand. She still did not understand. Turnips and flour are not the real valuables here.
Then what is? We have little else.
You're wrong. You have a dozen boys who would make perfect thieves and pickpockets.
I won't allow that to happen. When I came here, I vowed to keep these boys safe. I won't let them go the way of so many of the former residents.
You cannot stop it. You are one woman against deadly criminals and impossible odds.
Her gaze met his.
You faced death and impossible odds, and you came home a hero?
I came home a ghost. I should have died with the men I sent to their deaths.
Have you considered there's a reason you survived? What if you were spared because I needed you? What if you lived to save these boys? Bastards like you, but just as deserving of a chance in this world?
Neil felt cold seep through his veins. He was no hero. He was not the man to save these children, not the man Lady Juliana seemed to want him to be.
I have one mission, Lady Juliana, and that is to return you home.
I told you, she said tightly, I am home, and I will never give up on these boys or Sunnybrook.
Neil couldn't help but admire her spirit, misguided as she was.
She was stubborn and idealistic, a dangerous mixture, and one he couldn't quite seem to resist.
12. She didn't know where Mr. Raxall disappeared to after their conversation. He'd gone out in the rain and hadn't returned by dinner. She and the boys had enjoyed a delicious meal together, and Julia had initially been happy it would be just her and the boys at dinner. It would be like old times again, before Raxall had come. Except it wasn't. The boys had talked of little else throughout dinner. No one could say enough about when Major had done this, or when he'd said that, or how he'd promised to build Matthew, Mark and John a new enclosure. Julia had tried to steer the conversation away from Raxall, but the attempt had been only half-hearted. The truth was that Sunnybrook wasn't the same without him. She didn't know how that was possible when he'd only been there 2 days, but in that time they'd all become used to him and come to rely upon him. Now there was more than an empty chair where he usually sat. There was an empty spot in the boys' hearts, in hers as well, though she told herself it was a small spot that could be easily filled. The danger was in allowing the little piece of her heart he'd claimed to grow larger. She had to stop the attachment she felt from becoming any stronger. No more long conversations, no more nighttime eavesdropping, and no more kisses. Definitely no more kisses. In that spirit, she tried not to think of him the rest of the evening as the boys had played games or listened to her read, then complained when she made them wash faces and brush teeth and climb into their beds, beds that had clean linen and rooms that were spotless. But she would not think of that because noticing all of the changes would only lead to thoughts of Raxall. Finally, all the boys were tucked in. Julia checked with the new cook, who looked to have the kitchen in order and everything ready for the morning meal. Julia sent her to bed and told Mr. Goring he could retire. Part of Goring's job was to lock all the windows and doors at night, but considering what she knew about Goring, she checked everything again. All was secure. Was it possible Raxall had been wrong about Goring? After all, with the Major away, now would have been the perfect time to send Mr. Slag word she was alone and vulnerable, but Goring had stayed close all evening and locked everything up tightly. In fact, she was left with a dilemma. She was ready for bed, but Raxall still had not returned. He'd given her no information as to where he'd gone or when he'd be back. She did not want to leave the door open, but neither did she want to lock him out. Finally, she decided she would give him until midnight. If he hadn't returned by then, he was obviously not returning until the morrow. She built up the fire in the parlour and looked over correspondence and ledgers at her desk. But soon her eyes drooped, and since she only had an hour until midnight, she decided to rest on the couch. She opened her eyes what seemed like a moment later, and screamed at the man standing above her. Before much more than a squeak left her lips, his hand came down and covered her mouth. It was Slag, and he would kill her. Why hadn't she locked the door?
If you scream, you'll wake the children.
She stilled and stared up at the man, whose face was in shadow. He removed his hat, and she instantly relaxed. It was Raxel. Then anger replaced fear. She wrenched his hand from her mouth.
Just what are you about, sneaking in here and scaring me to death?
Sneaking in? I walked in.
The door was open, a matter I'd very much like to discuss with you. She sat and pushed her hair out of her eyes.
Oh, don't blame me for that. That is your fault, sir. I had no idea if you would return or not, and I did not want you banging on the door and scaring everyone to death when you returned to find the door locked.
Give me more credit than that. He moved away to stand by the fire, and in the light his features looked weary and a bit haggard. The man was exhausted.
Very well, she lowered her voice. You probably would have behaved like an idiot and sat outside all night, keeping vigil or some such nonsense. It's still raining, and you'd catch your death of cold. I don't want your death on my conscience.
He grinned at her.
Your concern is touching.
I hope so. Where have you been all night?
She was aware she sounded more like a wife than she ought, considering he was under no obligation to tell her anything.
At my club.
Drinking?
I wish. No, I've been talking with friends of mine about the situation with Mr. Slag.
What sort of friends?
The sort who can help me rid you of him permanently.
Do you mind? He pointed to the couch.
Mind?
If I join you.
He didn't wait for an answer. Instead, he sat heavily beside her. She almost fell into him, but managed to scoot over toward the arm and thereby maintain some space between them. Julia marveled at how small the couch seemed once he sat on it with her. She had considered moving it out of the parlour several times, as it was rather large for the small area, but now it felt decidedly too small. Julia also marveled that she was still seated beside him.
Why hadn't she stood up?
He laid his head on the back of the couch and closed his eyes.
"You should sleep, Mr. Raxel. You look terrible."
He smiled without opening his eyes.
"You do know how to give a compliment."
But she didn't know how else to describe him when he had the shadow of a beard on his jaw, dark circles under his eyes, and a pallor under his bronze skin.
"You can go to bed now," he said.
And how was she supposed to sleep when all she could think of was kissing him again?
"I have a bit more work to do."
She stood and moved to the desk. As soon as she was away from the couch, she felt colder and missed his scent of coffee and baked bread.
"Why don't you rest for a few moments while I finish?"
"I know what you're about," he said, his eyes still closed. "I'm perfectly fine. You can go to bed."
"I have no idea what you mean."
She sat at her desk and tried to look busy.
"This letter to the Prime Minister will not write itself. I promise to rouse you when I am finished and retire. In the meantime, I assume you trust me to keep vigil."
"Not a chance."
"Mr. Raxel, surely you assigned watches when you were in the army. You had to sleep at some point. Why not give me the watch for an hour, and then I promise to hand it back for the rest of the night?"
One eye opened, one bloodshot eye. "Fine. But if you don't wake me..."
"Yes, yes. The full power of your mighty wrath will fall upon me and my entire household. I will wake you, sir."
He opened the other eye and gave her an assessing look. Then, with a nod, he fell, rather than lay, on his side, and was snoring softly within seconds. Julia stared at him, rather awed at his ability to fall asleep so quickly. She usually had to read for at least an hour, then toss and turn until the bedclothes were perfectly arranged and fluff her pillow at least 5 times before her mind was quiet enough for her to consider drifting into slumber. Raxel seemed to need only to close his eyes. In case he was only pretending, she did write the letters she'd mentioned. Her father had told her about a bill he supported to give more aid to homes for unwed mothers. If the bill passed, Julia hoped more women would have the resources to keep their babies rather than give them up. She could not vote, of course, but she had been writing the Prime Minister weekly to express her support for the bill and to urge him to take up her father's cause. She finished her letter and, having penned a rather passionate epistle, did not feel at all tired. She checked the clock on the mantel and saw it was nearing one. Surely she could give the Major another half-hour of rest. She sorted through more correspondence and made notes in the boy's files, then finally had to admit her eyes would no longer stay open.